Jordan said hastily. That's not why we're here. This concerns something quite different. Preacher Scott raised his eyebrows. Now you've piqued my curiosity. It's a matter of some urgency, said Maya. Luke Garraway, our pack's leader. Preacher Scott gave her a sharp look, silencing her. Though he might have been packless, he was an alpha. That much was clear from his bearing. His eyes, under his thick eyebrows, were green-gray. Around his throat, under the collar of his shirt, sparkled the bronze pendant of the preacher with its imprint of a wolf's paw. The preacher chooses what matters it will regard as urgent, he said. Nor are we a hotel open to uninvited guests. Jordan took a chance in bringing you here, and he knows that. If he were not one of our most promising graduates, I might well send you both away. Jordan hooked his thumbs into the waistband of his jeans and looked at the ground. A moment later, Preacher Scott set his hand on Jordan's shoulder. But, he said, you are one of our most promising graduates, and you look exhausted. I can see you were up all night. Come, and we'll discuss this in my office. The office turned out to be down a long and winding hallway, elegantly paneled in dark wood. The house was lively with the sound of voices, and a sign saying, House Rules, was pinned to the wall beside a staircase leading up. House Rules. No shape-shifting in the hallways. No howling. No silver. Clothes must be worn at all times. All times. No fighting. No biting. Mark all your food before you put it in the communal refrigerator. The smell of cooking breakfast wafted through the air, making Maya's stomach grumble. Preacher Scott sounded amused. I'll have someone make us up a plate of snacks if you're hungry. Thanks, Maya muttered. They had reached the end of the hallway, and Preacher Scott opened a door marked Office. The older werewolf's eyebrows drew together. Rufus? He said, what are you doing here? Maya peered past him. The office was a large room, comfortably messy. There was a rectangular picture window that gave out onto wide lawns, on which groups of mostly young people were executing what looked like drill maneuvers, wearing black warm-up pants and tops. The walls of the room were lined with books about lycanthropy, many in Latin, but Maya recognized the word lupus. The desk was a slab of marble set upon the statues of two snarling wolves. In front of it were two chairs. In one of them sat a large man, a werewolf, hunched over, his hands gripped together.
Preacher, he said in a grating voice, I had hoped to speak with you regarding the incident in Boston.
The one in which you broke your assigned charge's leg, the preacher said dryly. I will be speaking to you about it, Rufus, but not this moment. Something more pressing calls me.
But, Preacher.
That will be all, Rufus, said Scott, in the ringing tone of an alpha wolf whose orders were not to be challenged. Remember, this is a place of rehabilitation. Part of that is learning to respect authority. Muttering under his breath, Rufus rose from the chair. Only when he stood up did Maya realize and react to his enormous size. He towered over both her and Jordan, his black t-shirt straining over his chest, the sleeves about the split around his biceps. His head was closely shaved, his face scored with deep claw marks all across one cheek, like furrows dug in soil. He gave her a sour look as he stalked past them and out into the hall.
Of course, some of us, Jordan muttered, are easier to rehabilitate than others.
As Rufus's heavy tread faded down the hall, Scott threw himself into the high-backed chair behind the desk and buzzed a joltingly modern-looking intercom. After requesting breakfast in a terse voice, he leaned back, hands clasped behind his head. I'm all ears, he said. As Jordan recounted their story and their request to Preacher Scott, Maya couldn't keep her eyes and mind from wandering. She wondered what it would have been like to have been raised here, in this elegant house of rules and regulations, rather than with the comparatively lawless freedom of the pack. At some point, a werewolf dressed all in black, it seemed to be the regulation outfit of the praetor, came in with sliced roast beef, cheese, and protein drinks on a pewter tray. Maya eyed the breakfast with some dismay. It was true that werewolves needed more protein than normal people, much more. But roast beef for breakfast? "You'll find," Praetor Scott said as Maya drank her protein shake gingerly, "that, in fact, refined sugar is harmful to werewolves. If you cease consuming it for a period of time, you will cease desiring it. Hasn't your pack leader told you that?" Maya tried to imagine Luke, who liked to make pancakes in odd and amusing shapes, lecturing her about sugar, and failed. Now was not the time to mention that, though. "No, he has, of course," she said. "I tend to, backslide in times of stress." "I understand your concern for your pack leader," said Scott. A gold Rolex glinted on his wrist. "Normally, we maintain a strict policy of non-interference regarding matters not related to new-fledged downworlders. We do not, in fact, prioritize werewolves over other downworlders, though only lycanthropes are allowed into the Praetor." "But that's exactly why we do need your help," said Jordan. "Packs are by their nature always moving, transitional. They have no opportunity to build up things like libraries of stored knowledge. I'm not saying they don't have wisdom, but everything is an oral tradition, and every pack knows different things. We could go from pack to pack, and maybe someone would know how to cure Luke. But we don't have time. Here," he gestured at the books lining the walls, "is the closest thing werewolves have to, say, the archives of the Silent Brothers, or the spiral labyrinth of the Warlocks." Scott looked unconvinced. Maya set her protein shake down. "And Luke isn't just any pack leader," she said. "He's the lycanthrope's representative on the council. If you help cure him, you would know that the praetor would always have a council voice in their favor." Scott's eyes glinted. "Interesting," he said. "Very well. I'll have a look through the books. It'll probably take a few hours. Jordan, I suggest that if you're going to drive back to Manhattan, you get some rest. We don't need you wrapping your truck around a tree." "I could drive," Maya began. "You look equally exhausted. Jordan, as you know, there will always be a room for you here at the Praetor House, even though you've graduated. And Nick is on assignment, so there's a bed for Maya. Why don't you both get some rest, and I'll call you down when I'm finished." He swiveled around in his chair to examine the books on the walls. Jordan gestured to Maya that this was their cue to leave. She stood up, brushing crumbs off her jeans. She was halfway to the door when Praetor Scott spoke again. "Oh, and Maya Roberts," he said, and his voice held a note of warning. "I hope you understand that when you make a promise in other people's names, it falls upon your head to make sure they follow through." Simon awoke, still feeling exhausted, blinking in the darkness. The thick black curtains over the windows let in very little light, but his internal body clock told him it was daytime. That, and the fact that Isabel was gone, her side of the bed rumpled, the covers turned back. Daytime, and he hadn't talked to Clary since she'd gone. He drew his hand out from under the covers and looked at the gold ring on his right hand. Delicate. It was etched with what were either designs or words in an alphabet he didn't know. Clenching his jaw, he sat up and touched the ring. "Clary?" The answer was immediate and clear. He nearly slid off the bed with relief. "Simon, thank God. Can you talk?" "No." He felt, rather than heard, a tense distraction in the voice of her mind. "I'm glad you spoke to me. But now isn't good. I'm not alone. But you're all right. I'm fine. Nothing's happened yet. I'm trying to gather information. I promise I'll talk to you the moment I hear anything. Okay, take care of yourself. You too." and she was gone. Sliding his legs over the side of the mattress, Simon did his best to flatten his sleep-mussed hair and went to see if anyone else was awake. They were. Alec, Magnus, Jocelyn, and Isabel sat around the table in Magnus's living room. While Alec and Magnus were in jeans, both Jocelyn and Isabel wore gear, Isabel with her whip wrapped around her right arm. She glanced up as he came in, but didn't smile. Her shoulders were tense, her mouth a thin line. They all had mugs of coffee in front of them. "There's a reason the ritual of the mortal instruments was so complicated." Magnus made the sugar bowl float over to himself and dumped some of the white powder into his coffee. "Angels act at the behest of God, not human beings, not even shadow hunters. Summon one, and you're likely to find yourself blasted with divine wrath. The whole point of the mortal instruments ritual wasn't that it allowed someone to summon Raziel. It was that it protected the summoner from the angel's wrath once he did appear."
"Valentine," Alec began.
"Yes. Valentine also summoned a very minor angel, and it never spoke to him, did it? Never gave him a sliver of help, though he harvested its blood. And even then, he must have been using incredibly powerful spells just to bind it. My understanding is that he tied its life to the Wayland Manor, so that when the angel died, the manor collapsed to rubble." He tapped a blue painted fingernail on his mug. "And he damned himself. Whether you believe in heaven and hell or not, he damned himself, surely. When he summoned Raziel, Raziel struck him down, partly in revenge for what Valentine had done to his brother Angel."
"Why are we talking about summoning angels?" Simon asked, perching himself on the end of the long table.
"Isabel and Jocelyn went to see the Iron Sisters," said Alec, "looking for a weapon that could be used on Sebastian that wouldn't affect Jace."
"And there isn't one?"
"Nothing in this world," said Isabel. "A heavenly weapon might do it, or something with a seriously demonic alliance. We were exploring the first option."
"Summoning up an angel to give you a weapon?"
"It's happened before," said Magnus. "Raziel gave the mortal sword to Jonathan Shadowhunter. In the old stories, the night before the Battle of Jericho, an angel appeared and gave Joshua a sword."
"Huh," said Simon. "I would have thought angels would have been all about peace, not weapons."
Magnus snorted.
"Angels are not just messengers. They are soldiers. Michael is said to have routed armies. They are not patient, angels. Certainly not with the vicissitudes of human beings. Anyone who tried to summon Raziel without the mortal instruments to protect them would probably be blasted to death on the spot. Demons are easier to summon. There are more of them, and many are weak. But then, a weak demon can help you only so much."
"We can't summon a demon," said Jocelyn aghast. "The Clave..."
"I thought you stopped caring what the Clave thought of you years ago," Magnus said.
"It's not just me," said Jocelyn. "The rest of you, Luke, my daughter. If the Clave knew..."
"Well, they won't know, will they?" said Alec, his usually gentle voice edged. "Unless you tell them."
Jocelyn looked from Isabel's still face to Magnus's inquiring one, to Alec's stubborn blue eyes.
"You're really considering this? Summoning a demon?"
"Well, not just any demon," said Magnus.
"Azazel."
Jocelyn's eyes blazed.
"Azazel?"
Her eyes scanned the others, as if looking for support. But Izzy and Alec glanced down at their mugs, and Simon just shrugged.
"I don't know who Azazel is," he said.
"Isn't he the cat from the Smurfs?" he cast about. But Isabel just looked up and rolled her eyes at him.
"Clary," he thought.
Her voice came through, tinged with alarm.
"What is it? What's happened? Did my mom find out I'm gone?"
"Not yet,"
he thought back. "Is Azazel the cat from the Smurfs?"
There was a long pause.
"That's Azrael, Simon. And no more using the magic rings for Smurf questions."
And she was gone. Simon glanced up from his hand and saw Magnus looking at him quizzically.
"He's not a cat, Sylvester," he said. "He's a greater demon. Lieutenant of Hell and Forger of Weapons. He was an angel who taught mankind how to make weapons, when before it had been knowledge only angels possessed. That caused him to fall, and now he is a demon. And the whole earth has been corrupted by the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin."
Alec looked at Magnus in amazement. "How do you know all that?"
"He's a friend of mine," said Magnus, and noting their expressions, sighed.
"Okay, not really, but it is in the Book of Enoch."
"Seems dangerous," Alec frowned. "It sounds like he's beyond a greater demon, even. Like Lilith."
"Fortunately, he is already bound," said Magnus.
"If you summon him, his spirit form will come to you, but his corporeal self will remain bound to the jagged rocks of Duduel."
"The jagged rocks of... oh, whatever," Isabel said, winding her long dark hair into a bun.
"He's the demon of weapons. Fine. I say we give it a go."
"I can't believe you're even considering this," said Jocelyn.
"I learned from watching my husband what dabbling in raising demons can do."
"Clary," she broke off then, as if sensing Simon's gaze on her, and turned.
"Simon," she said, "do you know, is Clary awake yet? We've been letting her sleep, but it's almost 11.
Simon hesitated.
"I don't know."
This, he reasoned, was true. Wherever Clary was, she could be sleeping, even though he had just talked to her.
Jocelyn looked puzzled. "But weren't you in the room with her?"
"No, I wasn't. I was..." Simon broke off, realizing the hole he'd just dug himself.
There were three spare bedrooms. Jocelyn had been in one, Clary the other. Which would obviously mean he must have slept in the third room with...
"Isabel?" said Alec, his eyebrows raised. "You slept in Isabel's room?"
Isabel waved a hand. "No need to worry, big brother. Nothing happened."
"Of course," she added as Alec's shoulders relaxed, "I was totally passed out drunk, so he could really have done whatever he wanted to me and I wouldn't have woken up."
"Oh, please," said Simon. "All I did was tell you the entire plot of Star Wars."
"I don't think I remember that," said Isabel, taking a cookie from the plate on the table.
"Oh, yeah? Who was Luke Skywalker's best childhood friend?"
"Biggs Darklighter," Isabel said immediately, and then hit the table with the flat of her hand.
"That is so cheating!"
Still, she grinned at him around her cookie.
"Ah," Magnus said, "nerd love. It is a beautiful thing, while also being an object of mockery and hilarity for those of us who are more sophisticated."
"All right, that's enough." Jocelyn stood up. "I'm going to get Clary. If you're going to raise a demon, I don't want to be here, and I don't want my daughter to be here either." She headed toward the hallway. Simon blocked her way.
"You can't do that," he said.
Jocelyn looked at him with a set face. "I know you're going to say that this is the safest place for us, Simon, but with a demon being raised, I just...
it's not that."
Simon took a deep breath, which didn't help since his blood no longer processed oxygen. He felt slightly sick.
"You can't go wake her up because... because she isn't here."
Chapter 10 The Wild Hunt. Jordan's old room at the Preter house looked like any dormitory room at any college. There were two iron-framed beds, each set against a different wall. Through the window separating them, green lawns were visible three floors down. Jordan's side of the room was fairly bare. It looked as if he had taken most of his photographs and books with him to Manhattan, though there were some tacked-up pictures of beaches and the ocean, and a surfboard leaning against one wall. A little jolt went through Maya as she saw that on the bedside table was a gold-framed photo of her with Jordan, taken at Ocean City, the boardwalk and the beach behind them. Jordan looked at the photograph and then at her. He blushed. He slung his bag onto his bed and stripped off his jacket, his back to her.
"When will your roommate be back?" she asked into the suddenly uncomfortable silence. She wasn't sure why they were both embarrassed. They certainly hadn't been when they'd been in the truck together. But now, here in Jordan's space, the years they'd spent not speaking seemed to press them apart.
"Who knows? Nick's on assignment. They're dangerous. He might not come back."
Jordan sounded resigned.
He tossed his jacket over the back of a chair.
"Why don't you lie down? I'm going to take a shower."
He headed for the bathroom, which, Maya was relieved to see, was attached to his room. She didn't feel like dealing with one of those shared bathroom down the hall things.
"Jordan," she began, but he'd already closed the bathroom door behind him. She could hear water running. With a sigh, she kicked off her shoes and lay down on the absent Nick's bed. The blanket was dark blue plaid and smelled like pine cones. She looked up and saw that the ceiling was wallpapered with photographs. The same laughing blonde boy, who looked about 17, smiled down at her out of each picture.
Nick, she guessed. He looked happy. Had Jordan been happy? Here at the Preter house?
She reached out and flipped the photograph of the two of them toward her. It had been taken years ago, when Jordan was skinny, with big hazel eyes that dominated his face. They had their arms around each other and looked sunburned and happy. Summer had darkened both their skins and put light streaks in Maya's hair, and Jordan had his head turned slightly toward her, as if he were going to say something or kiss her. She couldn't remember which. Not anymore. She thought of the boy whose bed she was sitting on, the boy who might never come back. She thought of Luke, slowly dying, and of Alaric, and Gretel, and Justine, and Theo, and all the others of her pack who had lost their lives in the war against Valentine. She thought of Max, and of Jace, two Lightwoods lost, for she had to admit in her heart she didn't think they would ever get Jace back. And lastly, and strangely, she thought of Daniel, the brother she had never mourned for. And to her surprise, she felt tears sting the back of her eyes. She sat up abruptly. She felt as if the world were tilting and she was clinging on helplessly, trying to keep from tumbling into a black abyss. She could feel the shadows closing in. With Jace lost and Sebastian out there, things could only get darker. There would only be more loss and more death. She had to admit, the most alive she'd felt in weeks had been those moments at dawn, kissing Jordan in his car. As if she were in a dream, she found herself getting to her feet. She walked across the room and opened the door to the bathroom. The shower was a square of frosted glass. She could see Jordan's silhouette through it. She doubted he could hear her over the running water as she pulled off her sweater and shimmied out of her jeans and underwear. With a deep breath, she crossed the room, slid the shower door open, and stepped inside. Jordan spun around, pushing the wet hair out of his eyes. The shower was running hot, and his face was flushed, making his eyes shine as if the water had polished them. Or maybe it wasn't just the water making the blood rise under his skin as his eyes took her in. All of her. She looked back at him, steadily, not embarrassed, watching the way the Preter Lupus pendant shone in the wet hollow of his throat, and the slide of the soap suds over his shoulders and chest as he stared at her, blinking water out of his eyes. He was beautiful. But then, she had always thought so. "Maya," he said unsteadily, "are you..."
"Shh." She put her fingers against his lips, drawing the shower door closed with her other hand. Then she stepped closer, wrapping both arms around him, letting the water wash both of them clean of the darkness.
"Don't talk. Just kiss me."
So he did.
"What in the name of the angel do you mean Clary isn't there?" Jocelyn demanded, white-faced. "How do you know that if you just woke up? Where is she gone?"
Simon swallowed. He'd grown up with Jocelyn as almost a second mother to him. He was used to her protectiveness of her daughter. But she had always seen him as an ally in that, someone who would stand between Clary and the dangers of the world. Now she was looking at him like the enemy. "She texted me last night," Simon began, then stopped as Magnus waved him over to the table. "You might as well sit down," he said. Isabel and Alec were watching wide-eyed from either side of Magnus, but the warlock didn't look particularly surprised. "Tell us all what's going on. I have a feeling this is going to take a while." It did, though not as long as Simon might have hoped. When he was done explaining, hunched over on his chair and staring down at Magnus's scratched table, he lifted his head to see Jocelyn fixing him with a green stare as cold as Arctic water. "You let my daughter go off with Jace? To some unfindable, untraceable place where none of us can reach her?" Simon looked down at his hands. "I can reach her," he said, holding up his right hand with the gold ring on the finger. "I told you. I heard from her this morning. She said she was fine." "You never should have let her leave in the first place!" "I didn't let her. She was going to go anyway. I thought she might as well have some kind of lifeline, since it's not like I could stop her." "To be fair," said Magnus, "I don't think anyone could. Clary does what she wants." He looked at Jocelyn. "You can't keep her in a cage." "I trusted you," she snapped at Magnus. "How did she get out?" "She made a portal." "But you said there were wards." "To keep threats out, not to keep guests in." "Jocelyn, your daughter isn't stupid, and she does what she thinks is right. You can't stop her. No one can stop her. She is a great deal like her mother." Jocelyn looked at Magnus for a moment, her mouth slightly open. And Simon realized that, of course, Magnus must have known Clary's mother when she was young, when she betrayed Valentine and the Circle and nearly died in the uprising. "She's a little girl," she said, and turned to Simon. "You've spoken to her? Using these rings? Since she left?" "This morning," said Simon. "She said she was fine, that everything was fine." Instead of seeming reassured, Jocelyn only looked angrier. "I'm sure that's what she said, Simon. I can't believe you allowed her to do this. You should have restrained her." "What, tied her up?" Simon said in disbelief. "Handcuffed her to the dinner table? If that's what it took, you're stronger than she is. I'm disappointed in..." Isabel stood up. "Okay, that's enough." She glared at Jocelyn. "It is totally and completely unfair to yell at Simon over something Clary decided to do on her own. And if Simon had tied her up for you, then what? Were you planning on keeping her tied up forever? You'd have to let her go eventually. And then what? She wouldn't trust Simon anymore, and she already doesn't trust you because you stole her memories. And that, if I recall, was because you were trying to protect her. Maybe if you hadn't protected her so much, she would know more about what is dangerous and what isn't, and be a little less secretive and less reckless." Everyone stared at Isabel. And for a moment, Simon was reminded of something that Clary had said to him once, that Izzy rarely made speeches, but when she did, she made them count. Jocelyn was white around the lips. "I'm going to the station to be with Luke," she said. "Simon, I expect reports from you every 24 hours that my daughter is all right. If I don't hear from you every night, I'm going to the Clave." And she stalked out of the apartment, slamming the door behind her so hard that a long crack appeared in the plaster beside it. Isabel sat back down, this time beside Simon. He said nothing to her, but held out his hand, and she took it, slipping her fingers between his. "So," Magnus said finally, breaking the silence, "who's up for raising Azazel? Because we're going to need a whole lot of candles." Jason Clary spent the day wandering through maze-like tiny streets that ran along canals whose water ranged from deep green to murky blue. They made their way among the tourists in St. Mark's Square and over the Bridge of Sighs and drank small, powerful cups of espresso at Café Florian. The disorienting maze of streets reminded Clary a bit of Alicante, though Alicante lacked Venice's feeling of elegant decay. There were no roads here, no cars, only twisting little alleys and bridges arching over canals whose water was as green as malachite. As the sky overhead darkened to the deep blue of late autumn twilight, lights began to go on, and tiny boutiques and bars and restaurants that seemed to appear out of nowhere and disappear again into shadow as she and Jace passed, leaving light and laughter behind. When Jace asked Clary if she was ready for dinner, she nodded firmly yes. She had begun to feel guilty that she had gotten no information out of him, and that she was actually enjoying herself. As they crossed over a bridge to the Dorso d'Oro, one of the quieter sections of the city, away from the tourist throng, she determined that she was going to get something out of him that night, something worth relaying to Simon. Jace held her hand firmly as they went over a final bridge and the street opened out into a great square on the side of an enormous canal the size of a river. The basilica of a domed church rose on their right. Across the canal, more of the city lit the evening, throwing illumination onto the water, which shifted and glimmered with light. Clary's hands itched for chalk and pencils, to draw the light as it faded out of the sky, the darkening water, the jagged outlines of the buildings, the reflection slowly dimming in the canal. Everything seemed washed with a steely blueness. Somewhere, church bells were chiming. She tightened her hand on Jace's. She felt very far away here, from everything in her life, distant in a way that she had not felt in Idris. Venice shared with Alicante the sense of being a place out of time, torn from the past, as if she had stepped into a painting or the pages of a book. But it was also a real place, one she had grown up knowing about, wanting to visit. She looked sidelong at Jace, who was gazing down the canal. The steely blue light was on him, too, darkening his eyes, the shadows under his cheekbones, the lines of his mouth. When he caught her gaze on him, he looked over and smiled. He led her around the church and down a flight of mossy steps to a path along the canal. Everything smelled of wet stone and water and dampness and years. As the sky darkened, something broke the surface of the canal water a few feet from Clary. She heard the splash and looked in time to see a green-haired woman rise from the water and grin at her. She had a beautiful face, but shark-like teeth and a fish's yellow eyes. Pearls were wound through her hair. She sank again below the water without a ripple. "Mermaid," said Jace. "There are old families of them that have lived here in Venice a long, long time. They're a little odd. They do better in clean water, far out to sea, living on fish instead of garbage." He looked toward the sunset. "The whole city is sinking," he said. "It'll all be underwater in 100 years. Imagine swimming down into the ocean and touching the top of St. Mark's Basilica." He pointed across the water. Clary felt a flicker of sadness at the thought of all of this beauty being lost. "Isn't there anything they can do? To raise a whole city? Or hold back the ocean?" "Not much," said Jace. They had come to a set of stairs leading up. The wind came off the water and lifted his dark gold hair off his forehead, his neck. "All things tend toward entropy. The whole universe is moving outward. The stars pulling away from one another. God knows what falling through the cracks between them." He paused. "Okay, that sounded a little crazy. Maybe it was all the wine at lunch. I can hold my liquor." They turned a corner, and a fairyland of lights gleamed out at them. Clary blinked, her eyes adjusting. It was a small restaurant with tables set outside and inside, heat lamps wound with Christmas lights like a forest of magical trees between the tables. Jace detached himself from her long enough to get them a table, and soon they were sitting by the side of the canal, listening to the splash of water against stone and the sound of small boats bobbing up and down with the tide. Tiredness was beginning to wash over Clary in waves, like the lap of water against the sides of the canal. She told Jace what she wanted and let him order an Italian, relieved when the waiter went away so she could lean forward and rest her elbows on the table, her head on her hands.
"I think I have jet lag," she said. "Interdimensional jet lag."
"You know, time is a dimension," Jace said.
"Pedant."
She flicked a breadcrumb from the basket on the table at him. He grinned. "I was trying to remember all the deadly sins the other day," he said. "Greed, envy, gluttony, irony, pedantry."
"I'm pretty sure irony isn't a deadly sin."
"I'm pretty sure it is." "Lust," she said. "Lust is a deadly sin. And spanking."
"I think that falls under lust."
"I think it should have its own category," said Jace. "Greed, envy, gluttony, irony, pedantry, lust, and spanking." The white Christmas lights were reflected in his eyes. He looked more beautiful than he ever had, Clary thought, and correspondingly more distant, more hard to touch. She thought of what he had said about the city sinking and the spaces between the stars, and remember the lines of a Leonard Cohen song that Simon's band used to cover, not very well. "There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." There had to be a crack in Jace's calm. Some way she could reach through to the real him she believed was still in there. Jace's amber eyes studied her. He reached out to touch her hand, and it was only after a moment that Clary realized that his fingers were on her gold ring.
"What's that?" he said. "I don't remember you having a fairy work ring."
His tone was neutral, but her heart skipped a beat. Lying straight to Jace's face wasn't something she had a lot of practice with.
"It was Isabel's," she said with a shrug. "She was throwing out all the stuff that fairy ex-boyfriend of hers gave her, Meliorn. And I thought this was pretty, so she said I could have it."
"And the Morgenstern ring?" This seemed like a place to tell the truth.
"I gave it to Magnus, so he could try to track you with it."
"Magnus." Jace said the name as if it were a stranger's and exhaled a breath.
"Do you still feel like you made the right decision? Coming with me here?"
"Yes. I'm happy to be with you. And, well, I always wanted to see Italy. I've never traveled much. Never been out of the country."
"You were in Alicante," he reminded her.
"Okay, other than visiting magical lands no one else can see, I haven't traveled much. Simon and I had plans. We were going to go backpacking around Europe after we graduated high school." Clary's voice trailed off. "It sounds silly now."
"No, it doesn't."
He reached out and pushed a strand of hair behind her ear.
"Stay with me. We can see the whole world."
"I am with you. I'm not going anywhere."
"Is there anything special you want to see? Paris? Budapest?
The Leaning Tower of Pisa?"
"Only if it falls on Sebastian's head," she thought. "Can we travel to Idris? I mean, I guess, can the apartment travel there?"
"It can't get past the wards." His hand traced a path down her cheek.
"You know, I really missed you."
"You mean you haven't been going on romantic dates with Sebastian while you've been away from me?"
"I tried," Jace said. "But no matter how liquored up you get him, he just won't put out."
Clary reached for her glass of wine. She was starting to get used to the taste of it. She could feel it burning a path down her throat, heating her veins, adding a dreamlike quality to the night. She was in Italy, with her beautiful boyfriend, on a beautiful night, eating delicious food that melted in her mouth. These were the kinds of moments that you remembered all your life. But it felt like touching only the edge of happiness. Every time she looked at Jace, happiness slipped away from her. How could he be Jace and not Jace all at once? How could you be heartbroken and happy at the same time? They lay in the narrow twin bed that was meant for only one person, wrapped together tightly under Jordan's flannel sheet. Maya lay with her head in the crook of his arm, the sun from the window warming her face and shoulders. Jordan was propped on his arm, leaning over her, his free hand running through her hair, pulling her curls out to their full length and letting them slide back through his fingers. "I missed your hair," he said, and dropped a kiss onto her forehead. Laughter bubbled up from somewhere deep inside her, that sort of laughter that came with the giddiness of infatuation.
"Just my hair?"
"No." He was grinning, his hazel eyes lit with green, his brown hair thoroughly rumpled. "Your eyes?" He kissed them, one after another. "Your mouth?" He kissed that, too. And she hooked her fingers through the chain against his bare chest that held the Praetor Lupus pendant. "Everything about you." She twisted the chain around her fingers. "Jordan, I'm sorry about before, about snapping at you about the money in Stanford. It was just a lot to take in." His eyes darkened, and he ducked his head. "It's not like I don't know how independent you are. I wanted to do something nice for you." "I know," she whispered. "I know you worry about me needing you, but I shouldn't be with you because I need you. I should be with you because I love you." His eyes lit up, incredulous, hopeful. You think it's possible you could feel that way about me again?" "I never stopped loving you, Jordan," she said. And he caught her against him with a kiss so intense it was bruising. She moved closer to him, and things might have proceeded as they had in the shower if a sharp knock hadn't come at the door. "Praetor Kyle!" A voice shouted through the door. "Wake up! Praetor Scott wishes to see you downstairs in his office." Jordan, his arms around Maya, swore softly. Laughing, Maya ran her hand slowly up his back, tangling her fingers in his hair. "Do you think Praetor Scott can wait?" she whispered. "I think he has a key to this room, and he'll use it if he feels like it." "That's all right," she said, brushing her lips against his ear. "We have lots of time, right? All the time we'll ever need." Chairman Meow lay on the table in front of Simon, completely asleep, his four legs sticking straight into the air. This, Simon felt, was something of an achievement. Since he had become a vampire, animals tended not to like him. They avoided him if they could, and hissed or barked if he came too close. For Simon, who had always been an animal lover, it was a hard loss. But he supposed, if you were already the pet of a warlock, perhaps you'd learn to accept weird creatures in your life. Magnus, as it turned out, hadn't been joking about the candles. Simon was taking a moment to rest and drink some coffee. It stayed down well, and the caffeine took the edge off the beginning prickles of hunger. All afternoon, they had been helping Magnus set the scene for raising Azazel. They had raided local bodegas for tea lights and prayer candles, which they had placed in a careful circle. Isabel and Alec were scattering the floorboards outside the circle with a mixture of salt and dried belladonna as Magnus instructed them, reading aloud from Forbidden Rites, a necromancer's manual of the 15th century. "What have you done to my cat?" Magnus demanded, returning to the living room carrying a pot of coffee with a circle of mugs floating around his head like a model of the planets rotating around the sun. "You drank his blood, didn't you? You said you weren't hungry." Simon was indignant. "I did not drink his blood. He's fine." He poked the chairman in the stomach. The cat yawned. "Second, you asked me if I was hungry when you were ordering pizza, so I said no, because I can't eat pizza. I was being polite." "That doesn't give you the right to eat my cat." "Your cat is fine." Simon reached to pick up the tabby, who jumped indignantly to his feet and stalked off the table. "See? Whatever." Magnus threw himself down in the seat at the head of the table. The mugs banged into place as Alec and Izzy straightened up, done with their task.
Magnus clapped his hands. Everyone, gather round. It's time for a meeting. I'm going to teach you how to summon a demon. Preeter Scott was waiting for them in the library, still in the same swivel chair, a small bronze box on the desk between them. Maya and Jordan sat down across from him, and Maya couldn't help wondering if it was written all over her face, what she and Jordan had been doing. Not that the Preeter was looking at them with much interest. He pushed the box toward Jordan. It's a salve, he said. If applied to Garraway's wound, it should filter the poison from his blood and allow the demon's steel to work its way free. He should heal in a few days. Maya's heart leaped. Finally, some good news. She reached for the box before Jordan could and opened it. It smelled sharply herbal, like crushed bay leaves. Preeter Scott began, his eyes flicking to Jordan. She should take it, said Jordan. She's close to Garraway and is part of the pack. They trust her.
Are you saying they don't trust the Preeter?
Half of them think the Preeter is a fairy tale, Maya said, adding, sir, as an afterthought. Preeter Scott looked annoyed, but before he could say anything, the phone on his desk rang. He seemed to hesitate, then lifted the receiver to his ear. Scott here, he said, and then, after a moment, yes, I think so. He hung up, his mouth curving into a not entirely pleasant smile. Preeter Kyle, he said, I'm glad you dropped in on us today of all days. Stay a moment. This matter somewhat concerns you. Maya was startled at this pronouncement, but not as startled as she was a moment later when a corner of the room began to shimmer and a figure appeared, slowly developing. It was like watching images appear on film in a dark room, and the figure of a young boy took shape. His hair was dark brown, short and straight, and a gold necklace gleamed against the brown skin of his throat. He looked slight and ethereal, like a choir boy, but there was something in his eyes that made him seem much older than that. Raphael, she said, recognizing him. He was ever so slightly transparent. A projection, she realized. She'd heard of them, but had never seen one up close. Preeter Scott looked at her in surprise. You know the head of the New York vampire clan? We met once, in Brosseland Woods, said Raphael, looking her over without much interest. She is a friend of the Daylighter, Simon. Your assignment, Preeter Scott said to Jordan, as if Jordan could have forgotten. Jordan's forehead creased. Has something happened to him? He asked. Is he all right? This is not about him, said Raphael. It is about the rogue vampire, Maureen Brown. Maureen, Maya exclaimed. But she's only, what, 13? A rogue vampire is a rogue vampire, said Raphael. And Maureen has been cutting quite a swath for herself through Tribeca and the Lower East Side. Multiple injured and at least 6 kills. We've managed to cover them up, but... She's Nick's assignment, said Preeter Scott with a frown. But he hasn't been able to find a trace of her. We may need to send someone with more experience. I urge you to do so, said Raphael. If the Shadow Hunters were not so concerned with their own emergency at this juncture, they would surely have involved themselves by now. And the last thing the clan needs after the affair with Camille is a censuring by the Shadow Hunters. I take it Camille is still missing as well, said Jordan. Simon told us everything that happened the night Jace disappeared, and Maureen seemed to be doing Camille's bidding. Camille is not new made, and is therefore not our concern, said Scott. I know, but find her, and you may find Maureen. That's all I'm saying, said Jordan. If she were with Camille, she would not be killing at the rate she is, said Raphael. Camille would prevent her. She's bloodthirsty, but she knows the conclave and the law. She would keep Maureen and her activities out of their line of sight. No, Maureen's behavior has all the hallmarks of a vampire gone feral. Then I think you're right, Jordan sat back. Nick should have backup in dealing with her, or... Or something might happen to him,
If it does, perhaps it will help you focus more in future, said Preeter Scott. On your own assignment. Jordan's mouth opened.
Simon wasn't responsible for turning Maureen, he said.
I told you. Preeter Scott waved away his words.
Yes, I know, he said. Or you would have been pulled from your assignment, Kyle. But your subject did bite her, and under your watch as well. And it was her association with the Daylighter, however distant, that led to her eventual turning.
The Daylighter is dangerous, said Raphael, his eyes shining. It is what I have been saying all along.
He is not dangerous, Maya said fiercely. He has a good heart.
She saw Jordan glance at her a little, sidelong, so quickly that she wondered if she'd imagined it.
Yep, 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 said Raphael dismissively. You werewolves cannot focus on the matter at hand. I trusted you, Preeter, for new-fledged downworlders are your department. But allowing Maureen to run wild reflects badly on my clan. If you do not find her soon, I will call up every vampire at my disposal. After all, he smiled, and his delicate incisors shone. In the end, she is ours to kill.
When the meal was over, Clary and Jace walked back to the apartment through a mist-shrouded evening. The streets were deserted and the canal water shone like glass. Rounding a corner, they found themselves beside a quiet canal, lined with shuttered houses. Boats bobbed gently on the curving water, each a half-moon of black. Jace laughed softly and moved forward, his hand pulling out of Clary's. His eyes were wide and golden in the lamplight. He knelt by the side of the canal, and she saw a flash of white silver, a steely, and then one of the boats sprang free of its mooring chain and began to drift toward the center of the canal. Jace slid the steely back into his belt and leaped, landing lightly on the wooden seat at the front of the boat. He held his hand out to Clary.
Come on.
She looked from him to the boat and shook her head. It was only a little bigger than a canoe, painted black, though the paint was damp and splintering. It looked as light and fragile as a toy. She imagined upending it and both of them being dumped into the ice-green canal.
I can't. I'll knock it over.
Jace shook his head impatiently.
You can do it, he said. I trained you.
To demonstrate, he took a step back. Now he was standing on the thin edge of the boat, just beside the oarlock. He looked at her, his mouth crooked in a half-smile. By all the laws of physics, she thought, the boat, unbalanced, ought to have been toppling sideways into the water. But Jace balanced lightly there, back straight, as if he were made of nothing more than smoke. Behind him was the backdrop of water and stone, canal and bridges, not a single modern edifice in sight. With his bright hair and the way he carried himself, he could have been some Renaissance prince. He held out a hand to her again.
Remember, you're as light as you want to be.
She remembered. Hours of training in how to fall, to balance, how to land like Jace did, as if you were a piece of ash sifting gently downward. She sucked her breath in and leaped, the green water flying by beneath her. She alighted in the bow of the boat, wobbling on the wooden seat, but steady. She let out her breath in a whoosh of relief and heard Jace laugh as he leaped down to the flat bottom of the boat. It was leaky. A thin layer of water covered the wood. He was also 9 inches taller than she was, so that with her standing on the seat in the bow, their heads were on a level. He put his hands on her waist.
So, he said, where do you want to go now?
She looked around. They had drifted far away from the bank of the canal.
Are we stealing this boat?
Stealing is such an ugly word, he mused.
What do you want to call it?
He picked her up and swung her around before putting her down.
An extreme case of window shopping.
He pulled her closer, and she stiffened. Her feet skidded out from under her, and the two of them slid to the curved floor of the boat, which was flat and damp and smelled like water and wet wood. Clary found herself resting on top of Jace, her knees on either side of his hips, Water was soaking into his shirt, but he didn't seem to mind. He threw his hands behind his head, folding them, his shirt pulling up.
"You literally knocked me down with the strength of your passion," he observed.
"Nice work, Frey."
"You only fell because you wanted to. I know you," she said.
The moon shone down on them like a spotlight, like they were the only people under it.
"You never slip."
He touched her face.
"I may not slip," he said, "but I fall."
Her heart pounded, and she had to swallow before she could reply lightly, as if he were joking.
"That may be your worst line of all time."
"Who says it's a line?" The boat rocked, and she leaned forward, balancing her hands on his chest, her hips pressed against his, and she watched his eyes as they widened, going from wickedly sparkling gold to dark, the pupils swallowing the iris. She could see herself and the night sky in them. He propped himself up on one elbow and slipped a hand around the back of her neck. She felt him arch up against her, lips brushing hers, but she drew back, not quite allowing the kiss. She wanted him, so much she felt hollow on the inside, as if desire had burned her clean through. No matter what her mind said, that this was not Jace, not her Jace, still her body remembered him, the shape and feel of him, the scent of his skin and hair, and wanted him back. She smiled against his mouth as if she were teasing him, and rolled to the side, curling next to him in the wet bottom of the boat. He didn't protest. His arm curved around her, and the rocking of the boat beneath them was gentle and lulling. She wanted to put her head on his shoulder, but didn't.
"We're drifting," she said.
"I know.
There's something I want you to see."
Jace was looking up at the sky. The moon was a great white billow, like a sail. Jace's chest rose and fell steadily, his fingers tangled in her hair. She lay still beside him, waiting and watching as the stars ticked by like an astrological clock, and she wondered what they were waiting for. At last she heard it, a long, slow, rushing noise, like water pouring through a broken dam. The sky darkened and churned as figures rushed across it. She could barely make them out through the clouds in the distance, but they seemed to be men, with long hair like cirrus clouds, riding horses whose hooves gleamed the color of blood. The sound of a hunting horn echoed across the night, and the stars shivered and the night folded in on itself as the men vanished behind the moon. She let her breath out in a slow exhalation.
"What was that?"
"The Wild Hunt," said Jace. His voice sounded distant and dreamlike. "Gabriel's hounds, the Wild Host. They have many names. They are fairies who disdain the earthly courts. They ride across the sky, pursuing an eternal hunt. On one night a year, a mortal can join them. But once you've joined the hunt, you can never leave it."
"Why would anyone want to do that?"
Jace rolled and was suddenly on top of Clary, pressing her down to the bottom of the boat. She hardly noticed the damp. She could feel heat rolling off him in waves, and his eyes burned. He had a way of propping himself over her so that she wasn't crushed, but she could feel every part of him against her. The shape of his hips, the rivets in his jeans, the tracings of his scars.
"There's something appealing about the idea," he said, "of losing all your control. Don't you think?"
She opened her mouth to answer, but he was already kissing her. She had kissed him so many times, soft, gentle kisses, hard and desperate ones, brief brushes of the lips that said goodbye, and kisses that seemed to go on for hours. And this was no different. The way the memory of someone who had once lived in a house might linger even after they were gone, like a sort of psychic imprint. Her body remembered Jace. Remembered the way he tasted, the slant of his mouth over hers, his scars under her fingers, the shape of his body under her hands. She let go of her doubts and reached up to pull him toward her. He rolled sideways, holding her, the boat rocking underneath them, Clary could hear the